My name is Dan Spencer. I'm one of the summer program coordinators here at Holden Village. And the topic of tonight's forum discussion is entitled Might versus Right, or Might or Right, Issues of U.S. Military Intervention from Panama to the Persian Gulf. We've got a panel of folks here who have agreed to help us get the conversation started, and I'll introduce them in just a moment. I'll just say a couple things about Holden Forums. The philosophy of Holden Forums is they're meant as conversation starters. We make no necessary effort to try and reach any consensus on issues. In fact, try and make some rather provocative statements oftentimes to get us going on some issues of which there may be a variety of perspectives. And our panel tonight, I think, will do that from a variety of perspectives in their area of expertise. So expect some lively discussion. Maybe you may expect some disagreement or agreement from quarters that may surprise you. We hope that the conversation will not end here after our hour together, but will continue on into the village during the week. And at this point, let me just introduce the folks who are here. On my far right is Lisa Kaiser, who's been here with her husband Stuart Taylor as part of the teaching staff. Lisa has been a member of Witness for Peace, both in Nicaragua and working out of the national office in Durham, North Carolina. Has an extensive history in Central America and did a session this past week on the issues around the Panama invasion. And tonight we'll be addressing some of those issues around the Panama invasion as one example of U.S. military intervention. To my immediate right is Charlie McConus. Charlie comes to us from Seattle, where he's the director of the Institute for Global Security Studies, which is a progressive research institute that receives a lot of support from churches, among other groups. But Charlie says that in the Holden context, he'd rather be known for being here in 1984 on teaching staff and teaching biblical theology out of the Book of Revelation. So we have a true Renaissance man on our panel tonight. But one of the areas that Charlie addresses is U.S. military issues, and is going to address some of the issues around the Persian Gulf crisis that's currently underway. And on my left is Brian Rood. Brian comes to us from north of the border. He's Canadian, a pastor with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada, and in the last year had spent 15 months in El Salvador as a missionary with the Lutheran Church there, until he was expelled nearly a year ago in November by the military and the government there during the increase in military hostilities, and since that time has been addressing issues around El Salvador. When we set up the forum tonight, what we thought we would do is take three different cases where U.S. policy has involved the U.S. military directly or fairly directly in efforts of U.S. policy. And in this case, the situation of a protracted war in El Salvador that's been going on for over 10 years now, a quick invasion of Panama, which took place last December, and then some of the events have taken place since then, and then the current military buildup and tensions in the Persian Gulf area. We thought we would take them in chronological order, begin with El Salvador, move to Panama, and then end up in the Persian Gulf. What we'd like to do tonight is focus on the question of what are the issues involved when the U.S. military is employed as part of U.S. foreign policy. And what criteria, if any, justify the involvement of the U.S. military outside our borders? Those are the kind of the questions at the heart of what's going to be presented. I think you'll see there'll be a variety of viewpoints here. We want to ask that question as U.S. citizens and ask that question as people of faith, how we respond to these international crises when the United States is involved in them. And I think with that, we will go ahead and have Brian address the issue of El Salvador, then move to Lisa on Panama, and finish with Charlie talking about the Persian Gulf. We've asked each of them to keep the remarks to 4 to 5 minutes so that we take no more than 15 minutes of presentation. I'll moderate that, and then we will move on into the discussion. We have a lot of chance for to take there. So with that, we'll go ahead.
Well, as a Canadian, I feel a little awkward talking about U.S. intervention to a crowd of mostly U.S. citizens. So I hope I don't come across sounding like a smug and self-righteous Canadian. I'm sure if we could intervene, we would. And in fact, we've just revived three 30-year-old warships, or battleships, to send to the Persian Gulf. A six-month project completed in 1 week. So El Salvador is a situation, as Dan has mentioned, of protracted civil war. And the U.S. involvement in El Salvador has not been direct intervention. I think as a follow-up to Vietnam especially, the U.S. administration learned that prolonged intervention in a situation like that, in a civil war like that of El Salvador, would not be in the best interests and would likely or ultimately not be favored by the U.S. citizens. And so they've developed more covert or more discreet ways of intervening. Some of those are directly military, in terms of sending military aid. Some of them are more economic, psychological. Policy has been developed called low-intensity conflict, and that involves a whole variety of methods. Aid to El Salvador is extensive. It's over $1 million a day. A significant portion of that is direct military aid, but also the economic aid is used as a part of this low-intensity conflict strategy in counterinsurgency projects, where the government is assisted to develop projects in various communities around the country. And the idea is to win the hearts and minds of the people, to convince the people that the government and its forces are benevolent, are interested in the welfare of the people. And so those projects are carried out as part of that counterinsurgency strategy. That strategy also has its facets in the United States as part of the communications strategy. It's a strategy, I think, which involves a lot of cover-up of information, a lot of, and also to some extent disinformation to U.S. citizens, so that the full picture is not understood by the people of the U.S., at least not through the mainstream media. There are, of course, alternative sources, and I suspect that many or most of you are aware of those, the church being one of those. Part of that strategy is, of course, not supporting, not wanting international workers to be in the country as witnesses. Seeing what happens, being a part of what happens, and then as witnesses in telling about the situation which is current in the country, in our own countries, in our own churches, and so on. For instance, during the offensive, there was always the possibility that the U.S. would intervene directly with troops and so on, if the offensive should turn sour for the El Salvadoran government, if it appeared at some point that they would lose militarily to the FMLN. But certainly that was not the preference. There was significant military assistance. There are 60 military advisors acknowledged, U.S. military advisors acknowledged to be in El Salvador. And beyond that, there are always suspicions that there was more assistance. Things like a troop or the Green Beret surprisingly showing up at the Sheraton Hotel. On vacation, I'm not sure, but equipped with M16s, mm-hmm. and other military personnel coming out of areas of conflict, zones of conflict right within the city of San Salvador, and not being able to explain their presence there. In terms of the Air Force, much of the war was fought from the air by the Salvadoran Air Force, and it was felt by most Salvadorans that the Salvadoran pilots had not had sufficient training to conduct strikes of that delicacy. And in fact, some radio communications were picked up by journalists such as Frank Smythe and so on, which indicated that actually U.S. pilots might have been flying some of those operations. So there are always questions about the actual level of U.S. military involvement. Um, So just as an introduction, it's a low-intensity warfare. It's a more discreet a policy which doesn't attract or doesn't invite the reaction of the U.S. public to the extent that the policies in Vietnam did.
Okay, we move from the looking at a case of low-intensity warfare to more direct military intervention with the invasion of Panama in December. Lisa, if you want to address that.
Sure. I think I'd like to start out just real quickly with a quote from Dom Helder Câmara, who is a Brazilian archbishop. It's called "Do Not Fear the Truth." And the reason I'm saying this, I want to make very clear, is not so much that I feel like I have the truth, but I think that finding the truth is a really hard thing to do, and I hope we can all stick with it tonight. "Do not fear the truth, hard as it may appear, grievously as it may hurt. It is still right, and you were born for it. If you go out to meet it and love it, let it exercise your mind. It is your best friend and your closest sister." I wanted to start out with that because I think that since I've only got 5 minutes, I'm just going to give you the fast, quick, and dirty version of what I think about the invasion. And I looked at this with two questions in mind. What is the role of the U.S. citizen, our role as citizens, in responding to an invasion? And I think it's really important that we keep that key on the word invasion because that's what it was. And then secondly, what is our role as people of faith, as Christians, in responding to an invasion on the part of our country? In terms of the first question, you know, what is the role of the U.S. citizen in response, I picked out what I think are just some basic criteria that I think many of us would agree upon. First is, you know, in terms of our country invading another country, I think there would want to be a respect for human life. And one of the things that has come out in terms of the invasion is that 2,000 to 5,000 Panamanian citizens were killed as a result of the invasion. I think the other thing that came out we need to talk about in terms of respect for human life is the fact that the stealth bomber was tested for the first time during the invasion, and one-ton bombs were being dropped into densely urban areas. And the third thing is that 18,000 people were left homeless as a result of the invasion. And so if I'm starting to throw these out quickly, again, it's just because I have 5 minutes. I think the second thing when you start talking about an invasion is I would want our country to have respect for international law. The fact of the matter is that we broke three major bodies of international law, that being the Panama Canal Treaty, the Organization of American States Treaty, and the UN Charter. And just at this point, I'll say, of course, we'll have time afterwards to discuss this, so if you have questions, please bring them up afterwards. The third thing I think that there need to be is respect for the right of self-determination of all nations. And I think one of the greatest myths that was put forward is the fact that the Panamanians invited us and were welcoming this invasion. The truth of the matter is that we've invaded or intervened in Panamanian affairs 13 times in the century, that the government which was put in place, being Endara's government, was never informed of the invasion or asked beforehand. They were told 3 hours before the invasion that we were coming. And that there was a great amount of dissent among Panamanians over this, including church groups, human rights groups, that said immediately that they called for the withdrawal of the troops. So that's another point, the respect of the right of people to self-determination of their nation. I think the fourth point is I think that there needs to be clarity between what are truly our national interests and what are improper motives for an intervention or an invasion. And I'm just going to pick two of the ones that were put forward as being our national interests. The first being that we were there to protect U.S. lives. And I think we all remember, most of us would remember the account of the military, the serviceman who was killed. I think behind that account, just starting to look at what the truth is here, is the fact that most people don't know that that service person was driving in a car with five other service people that went through a military barricade into an area of Panama that was not under U.S. jurisdiction, that the car was repeatedly asked to stop, and when the car continued to approach a sensitive military area, only then was it fired upon. So there's that one thing. The other thing about this whole question of our interests in protecting U.S. lives is that before the invasion, we already had 12,000 U.S. troops in Panama as part of our bases there, and that was a number equal to the Panamanian troops. So how many more troops we needed to really protect U.S. lives is an important question to ask. I think the second thing that was put forward in terms of our interests, and I think many people are very concerned about this, and rightly so, is that we were there to stop drugs and stop a drug dealer. Trying to pull a few pieces out there, I'll just put out 3 points. The first being that Noriega was already a known drug dealer way before we cut off our actions with him, and in fact we were paying him up to $200,000 a year in when he was working with the CIA, when we already knew he was a drug dealer. So there's that question. The second is, if we really are that concerned about drug dealing and stopping drug intervention into our country, why is it that we continue our contacts with the Honduran and Guatemala military, funding them when they both have well-known drug contacts, as well as the Contras, which many of us know some of the history about the drug dealing with the Contras. So there's that point. And the third and a very unfortunate fact is that drug smuggling has actually increased since the invasion through Panama. So putting out those points. I think, again, in terms of what we need to think about as U.S. citizens when we look at, is it right to go in and have an invasion, is do we really understand the people, the history, and the context of the place that we are invading so that we have a sense that if we invade, what happened afterwards will be a good thing? And I think that in Panama, the case, unfortunately, was no. I really don't think we had a very clear understanding. Maybe perhaps the people who did the invasion had a clearer understanding than we did. But the first is that as a result of the invasion, there has been an incredible economic devastation and destabilization of Panama. We went in and had an invasion after we had over 2 years of an economic blockade on Panama. The result of this is the invasion itself cost $1 billion worth of damage. This is on top of the economic damage that was done by the embargo. The amount of aid that we are now thinking about giving Panama is only $480 million. So we're not even getting halfway towards covering what the invasion itself caused in terms of economic damage to that country. So those are some of the things thinking about. The other very unfortunate thing in terms of the politics and what's happened after and since the invasion is that the Andara government has put into place leaders of the new military and the new police that actually have a worse human rights record than a number of the people that had been in Noriega's government. And so what you're seeing is a situation of political repression, of protests, especially among the homeless. Those 18,000 homeless are still homeless. And you're also seeing a history of people who had been in power before, mainly the upper and middle classes, coming back into power and seeing things such as where the most devastated neighborhoods in Panama City, the poor people who lost their homes because of the bombing and the way the invasion happened are actually now being bought out and forced out. And many of these areas that have been bombed out are being torn into major commercial and tourist areas. The government is funding those tourist areas and the upper level development, but no funding has gone to helping the homeless. And so that's some of those issues putting out there. One more minute. I'm actually getting through this. I'm shocked. Actually, that's okay because I think the second point is equally important, but it's a little bit easier to get through. And that is, what are we as people of faith called to do in terms of responding to an invasion? And here I'll put forward my very personal views. I think the first is that people of faith are called to respond to conflicts like this nonviolently and to ask our government to seek nonviolent resolutions of conflicts. I think there's a lot of analysis about what happened in Panama, that there were many nonviolent ways to resolve this conflict that were not sought out. And so going in militarily was in some ways, I think it's very unnecessary. I think that sense of being called to be peacemakers is something that we can pick up from the people of Eastern Europe, for example, and how they have been able to bring about tremendous change without using violent means. I think the second thing that we need to do as people of faith goes back to the quote I started with, and that is I think we are called to be questioners of our government, and to do that in a really loving way, and I mean that very seriously, to not feel like by asking questions about what really happened or what our government is really doing is not loving our country. I think it's actually the opposite. I think the third thing that we are called to do is to respect international law and to be a model of that. The fourth thing is I think we need to atone for the damage that we do if we go in militarily. One of the, again, very sad aftermath of the Panama invasion is that the U.S. has refused to recognize any of the suits that has been brought against it by people who lost people, people who were killed in the invasion or people who were injured. And so by refusing to recognize it, it has actually been brought in front of the World Court, and there are now suits against the U.S. government by Panamanian civilians for the damages that were done. And I think that as people of faith, we should call our government to respond to those and to acknowledge the damage that was done during the invasion. And the fourth one is a biggie, but I'll just put it out there since I know my last minute is up. I really think that we are called to a repentance of our sins as people who seek power. And I think a lot about what was happening in Panama was a desire to keep control of the canal, as well as a desire to put forward our vision of policy in Central America. And I didn't get a whole lot of chance to go into that. But I think we really, that goes back to what I was saying before, the need to really, as a people of faith, start a process of questioning earnestly what truly are our national interests. And then from that, decide what is, if anything, a good basis for an intervention.
Thank you, Lisa. We move then from a case of a U.S. initiated invasion to now responding to an invasion in the Middle East. Charlie, I'll just say.
Thank you. Well, like many of you, I'm sure we all sent in our reservation so many months ago. We never dreamed that we would be coming to Holden at a point in time where our country and indeed perhaps a major portion of the world seemed poised on the brink of war, which is certainly the case with the crisis in the Persian Gulf right now. And so I had second thoughts about coming at all, because responding to these sorts of things is my job. But then I thought that, fortunately I had third thoughts, and came anyhow, figuring that a week away from thinking about all that would probably do me a lot of good, since I had lost a great deal of sleep. Alas, my cover was blown, and somebody here knows who I am, so I agreed to be on the panel. And I was lamenting that a little bit today. Had a wonderful day with the kids at Narnia, and then out hiking, and was coming out with an ice cream cone at 2:30 this afternoon, went right over our heads, if any of you are out there right now. Came a jet plane. It was a Navy A-6 attack bomber on his way back from the test range in Boardman, Oregon, heading to Whidbey Island, probably toning up, and it's going to hop and be ferried over to the Middle East. So within earshot of Holden, the situation is with us, whether we like it or not. As an American citizen and as a person of faith, and in my own case, one who professes nonviolence, I think the first thing that has to be said, and I'm not going to get into the incredibly complex background of how things got to this point, we can get into that later, but the invasion of Kuwait by Iraq is certainly one of the clearest cases of unjustified aggression since the end of World War II. And it poses a real dilemma, I think, for all of us as American citizens and as Christians in our response to the issue of massive military violence, the question of war. For myself, I think that this is, if ever there was an instance where there was a justified role for some form of American military force outside of our borders, this is the kind of case that one could hold up. However, I think it's very clear also that the nature of the military forces that the United States has developed over the last 45 years have been enormously powerful, provocative, offensive forces designed primarily to fight and win a war with the Soviet Union. Thank God that possibility seems to have receded. What the world is faced with as a military danger now is regional wars of the sort that this one is. There have always been regional wars, only they mean a lot more now because of the modern age in which we live, because of technology and because of resources. And neither the United States nor the rest of the world can afford to ignore them. My guess is that most of us ignored the war between Iran and Iraq because it didn't seem to have much to do with us. I happen to have paid a lot of attention to that sort of thing because that's my job. And now it's back to haunt us. Guess whose side we were on in that war? The United States. Who we backed, who we helped, Iraq. So 2.5 years ago, we were on the side of the country that just now invaded Kuwait, which tells you something about some of the background of this. And nevertheless, the world cannot let this sort of thing go on. Because this sort of thing, the next time it might be between India and Pakistan, both of which have nuclear weapons. Consequently, and I'll close with this, I think this is an example, if one were to pick one. I still have my grave doubts because of my deep convictions in nonviolence. So I'm very tortured and disturbed by this one. But I think it's the best possible case for a use of American military forces abroad. However, I would insist only, always and only, under the aegis of the United Nations in cooperation with international forces who have agreed that an issue has reached that level of seriousness. I do think, in this case, the United States deployed forces too quickly, too provocatively, before that consensus was built, and then backwardsly scrambled rather desperately to build that consensus, to get that consensus, and it has now come to the point where the United, and I thank David Curley who brought news in today, that the United Nations Security Council has authorized the use of minimum force to uphold the blockade against Iraq. In other words, just the minimum force necessary to stop Iraqi ships from being able to carry on trade. This may be a case where military force is necessary.
Thank you, Charlie. At this time, we will open it up to the rest of the room here. We've heard several different strongly held views, some different positions, different criteria. Just go back to some of the questions I raised at the beginning that you may find a helpful way to frame your own thoughts or questions. In terms of what issues are involved when the U.S. military is employed abroad, and what criteria need to be considered. We've heard both perspectives as U.S. citizens and also as people of faith. So at this point, let's open it up, and I see a hand back here.
I'd just like to make a couple of points. The title this evening was Military Intervention, Might or Right, as I understood it. With all due respect to Brian, I think that using El Salvador's military intervention is stretching the point pretty thin. 60 military advisors, some undercover CIA, is hardly military intervention on our part. The fact that the government is providing a great deal of military weapons may fit your definition, but I think that's really stretching the point in El Salvador. Certainly, there's a great deal to discuss about our policy. Number two, I think it's important that we keep in mind, as the moderator pointed out, that the military is an instrument of national policy. Mercifully, in this country, under the Constitution, the military responds to civilian government. So, when we talk about the military, we're talking about them being used as instruments of national policy set by the President, the Congress, and other civilian leaders. Certainly I would acknowledge with the advice of military leaders. That said, civilians have the final say, and I say thank goodness for that. Number three is, I think as we discussed this evening, we should remember, I think, that when we speak about our government, we are the government. We elect officials, or by the absence of our concern and interest and action, we allow those who are there to stay there. Now, there are all kinds of discussions that we could get into there. But we ought to be a little careful as we talk about them in Washington, or they, because we are they. In many cases, we allow them to be.
People hear the question about filling in about the National Security Act and the National Security Council.
Yeah. Well, those are very good questions, because while I certainly agree with your point, sir, that certainly on any relative scale, civilians have a much greater role in shaping national policy and foreign policy in the United States than they do in any other major power in the world, bar none. The fact of the matter is that in actual wartime, governments deem it necessary to operate under veils of secrecy which run counter to democratic principles. And the problem is that World War II never really ended. The Cold War began virtually the day World War II ended. And under the pressures of the Cold War, the United States enacted a number of laws which created something that I would describe as a shadow government, relatively free from civilian oversight or control. And the authorizing acts were all passed in 1947, in which the outline, the setting up the Joint Chiefs of Staff, setting up the Central Intelligence Agency, etc., 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 created a vast apparatus. It refined and made permanent a war-fighting apparatus of the sort that beat Hitler. And it was that kind of apparatus that enabled Ollie North to do the sort of things that he did without the American people either knowing, even Congress knowing, and things going on in our name that we did not want and were unable to stop, and even afterwards are unable apparently to sort of clear up. So you're raising a good point. And this, in an issue like the Persian Gulf thing, the question of the U.S. President's ability as Commander-in-Chief to send U.S. military forces abroad, of course, became a very controverted one during Vietnam, and it was passed the War Powers Act, which says that, yes, an American commander, American president can send U.S. forces abroad for 60 days, and then Congress has to say yay or nay. And initially, there has to be a lot of notification. Well, the White House, every administration, the Reagan administration and the Bush administration have said without formally challenging that act is unconstitutional and they will not abide by it. They did not give the kind of advance notice to Congress of sending troops to Saudi Arabia that act calls for. So there's a great struggle that still exists between the executive branch of the American government and the legislative branch in controlling U.S. foreign actions.
Other responses?
To sort of continue the discussion of where and how military expertise and experience and desires enter into the formulation of policy, I think that we can see a kind of clear history of the Army's, especially the Army's response to its experience in Vietnam being played out in a very cautious policy in Hawaii, where, as I understand it, really was the Army that kept existing to civilian presidents and defense agencies that it did not want to be involved in the ground war.
Can you speak up? We can't hear back. Yeah.
I'm sorry. The Army did not want to be involved in a ground war in Nicaragua and El Salvador if it could not be assured of several things. One of them was clear civilian support at home, and the other was clearly defined policy and achievable policy objectives in the arena, and not being satisfied on either point. And there may have been some others. Sort of said, we really don't want to go into it. Second thing I think that's clear in the progression of the Army's thinking about this kind of thing is that if the Army does want to go in, if armed forces are to be used, they're to be used in a way that puts overwhelming force on the ground as soon as possible, so that conflicts are short if possible, and so the armed forces don't have to keep going back to the American people and asking for raising the ante the way happened in Vietnam, where we put in 50,000 Marines into Da Nang and then another 100,000 or another 100,000 in front of them, and you're up to 500,000 armed forces. So I think those kinds of things, there's a kind of parallel track of the way the armed forces have thought out their experiences that have resulted in some of the shape of the way these conflicts have been responded to. And I think that there is a real danger in the quote successes of Grenada and Panama. And now, still larger kind of response in Saudi Arabia. The last thing I want to say about that sort of thing is that I agree with Charlie that if ever there was a time when armed intervention might be justified, Kuwait probably is that kind of time. And I think the intervention in Saudi Arabia was what it is is advertised to be, that is a kind of, whatever happens, we don't want any other of the Gulf states to be invaded. But I do think that both in the American public as a whole and in military thinking, there is way too little thought paid to the issues you raised, which is, how do these things look to the people on the ground? What's likely to be a long-term response to military intervention? And what, how will that play out in terms of our long-term desires?
I don't, to respond to the last thing that you said, I don't think that the American public necessarily cares anymore. I think we've distanced ourselves from that, and that what's disturbing to me in the wake of Panama and the violation of the OAS treaties, the UN treaty, also the Panama Canal treaty, is that when an occasion arose that if indeed the consensus is that there was ever something that was justified for US military to go in, it was the US military racing in and then backwards trying to kind of cover the bases and say, is that all right with you, United Nations? And so this momentum that we've established and how quickly we've returned to it with the situation in Kuwait tells me that we're pretty oblivious to any kind of condemnation by the member bodies of these treaties that we say we abide by, and that's just really disturbing to me.
Well, I think you're making a very valid point, which is that the nature of the military forces that the United States has put into place are, just as David said, are such that, well, okay, we all agree we don't ever want to ever again get into a long, drawn out, slow, bloody, controversial war on the ground far away. So if we have to get into war, let's do it. Well, that's, it may be morally tragic in Grenada and Panama, but the horrible truth of the matter is that in terms of naked American might,
they got away with it both times, relatively speaking. For one thing, because they were able to do it so doggone fast. Same thing here. I think the American, you know, I'm enormously relieved and I'm mildly astonished that we're not at war with Iraq, that we didn't haven't already done an airstrike kind of thing. I suspect, and here this is how horrible a world we live in now. I suspect that the main reason is because Saddam was smart enough to start using all the Americans in that country as hostages and saying, you do that, and they're history. And that's not going to go over well in Peoria. I think that, you know, I don't think that, that cooler heads prevailed. I think that it was the Bush administration said, gee, if we blow up Baghdad, 3,000 Americans are going to get killed, and that won't look good. And that's why we didn't. We have enormously powerful offensive forces poised around Iraq. You don't. Aircraft carriers and amphibious marine assault units and B-52 bombers are not defensive forces. They are forces that are designed to enable you to go on the offensive. Thank God, so far, they've been restrained, and now, you know, the whole thing is being much more enmeshed in an international context. The European nations are much more involved. The Soviet Union is very much involved, the United Nations. So I'm hoping and praying that we're past the worst danger point in terms of the Gulf thing exploding into full-blown war.
Jimmy, hand up here, and we'll just go around the room.
Yeah. The question of Panama, you raised a tablet full of things that we did that were bad. I didn't hear anything good that we did. You raised up all of these things, the things that we had done that were bad. It raised the question, what have we done that is bad? And you know, it's well valid to identify them, but I don't think it is valid to leave it there. You raised the question, why? From hearing the what of you talked about, it would appear that the answer to why we did it would have to be either that we are stupid or that we are corrupt. What is your response to the why that we did all of that?
I think you've raised a really good point, and I think the hardest thing about me, for me, talking about what happened in Panama, is that my first response was, and even after someone who'd been in Central America long term, my first response was, gee, this is really hard to respond to because Noriega wasn't a good guy and, you know, Panama is better off without him. And it wasn't until I started really digging into it and kind of learning more about what actually happened that I came to this conclusion that it wasn't good for us to beat him. In terms of the why, I think there's a lot of answers, and I could give you mine. I really do think it had a lot to do with what happened in 1985 when Noriega went along with the Contadores signing, actually it was in late 1984, and refused to go along with the Reagan administration policies about Nicaragua. He refused to send in Panamanian forces to Nicaragua, and he refused to participate in the embargo of Nicaragua. And so I think at that point you can see a lot of turning around, I think, of U.S. policy, and I think that was the point when we started to work against Noriega and turning there. That's a really long thing, but basically 1990 was the year we were supposed to turn over the vast majority of control of the canal, and I think there was a lot of feeling that we didn't want to turn it over to Noriega.
You think that's why we went in and did what we did?
Yeah, I really do feel like that's a lot, but I think there's a lot of people who would feel differently. For me, the important thing about getting at the what was simply to bring forward in my heart of hearts what I think were really horrible human costs and to start putting into balance, even if there were good reasons, and I'm sorry there aren't other people here to put forward more of what I think some people would argue were really good reasons, but to say even with good reasons, you know, when 5,000 civilians get killed or you know, that kind of thing. Where, at what point do we say it was the right thing to do? What have there been other ways to achieve the same thing?
And here and there.
My question for Lisa, too. My understanding is Indira was legitimately elected, correct, by the people.
Well, actually, what happened was interesting. They never found out because Noriega termed the election null and void before the votes were.
But I think the consensus is that he was freely elected by the people. Is that?
I think that is a fair consensus.
Well, then you, and without trying to justify what we did or whether it was good or bad in answering those questions you pointed out, you talked about right of self-determination. Without the intervention of the United States. And then you give a litany of complaints against Indira and his government. It doesn't track. You can't have it both ways. Indira was part of their self-determination, if you agree that he was legitimately elected by the people, regardless what Noriega let occur or not occur. That's just a comment. As a generalized comment, in my own personal life, what can we do about these? Again, is the involvement of individuals with members of our government. And I certainly would not argue with Charlie about shadow governments and things that almost seem to be beyond our power, but it is not beyond our power. That's the beauty of a democracy. It is not beyond our power to change our government for things we don't like. And it's too big for me, and it's too tough, and they're too powerful is absolute nonsense. They are not. We are the power. That is the beauty in a democracy. And the woman up here that said we don't care, a lot of us don't. That is indeed part of the problem. We're too self-centered and too busy with our own lives to care about what's going on in the rest of the world. Amen, lady. But we can change it. And for me, that is the way I deal with it. In trying to deal with my elected representative, in working for people that I think politically can fulfill the things I would like for my town, my city, my country. And you may say that's naive, but I'll stand up and defend that all day long.
You know, you made a very good point there. There's one issue here. Intervention sort of implies that there aren't any American troops in a place, and then all of a sudden we put them there. But of course, Central America in general, Panama in particular, and also the Philippines and Korea pose another aspect of this, which we haven't. I just want to raise it for our fact. You know, to what country, to what extent can a nation consider itself to be sovereign? If it has large numbers of foreign troops based on its soil with all of the implicit power that represents. For example, it's clear that the only reason that the Aquino government is still in power right now was that at a point where the latest coup was about to succeed, American planes based in the Philippines provided just the kind of implicit coercion to make the coup fail, and that saved the Aquino government temporarily. But the overwhelming long-term impact of that, I think, has been negative for democracy in the Philippines, in that the message seems to have been that, well, the Aquino government is just another American construct, and without American support, it wouldn't exist. So I think anything that happens in Panama, when you've got 12,000, which for a country the size of Panama, American troops there, raises the question, to what extent is that a sovereign nation to begin with? And I certainly think that of all foreign. I don't think that a country is sovereign if it has large numbers of somebody else's army inside of it. That's sort of a permanent invasion, even if originally there was some veneer of justification. And we want to get all Russians out of Eastern Europe, and I think we ought to get Americans and those sort of things. Pardon?
How about Cuba?
Oh, yeah, I think we ought to get both the Russians and the Americans out of Cuba. Guantanamo, we have a base in Cuba. Does everybody remember that? It's a huge American military base in Cuba. Guantanamo Bay.
I just want to make, we had this discussion a little bit last week when Lisa presented some stuff, and I, at the risk of sounding like a broken record for people who were there last week, I just, having spent a little bit of time traveling in Central America during the during the last couple of years, I've come to a few conclusions. Number one, most of our foreign policy since World War II, certainly in the last 20, 30 years, has been based on trying to support our way of life. I think the myth that the United States is the guardianship of freedom in the world is gone. I mean, the fact that we support a government like El Salvador, Guatemala, which has killed 100,000 of its people, South Africa, these countries which are well known by international observers as being the worst human rights violators in the hemisphere are countries that we're pouring money into. So I think that we have to realize that our foreign policy is based on trying to support our standard of living. And the Persian Gulf is a classic example. We've got 2% of the world's population here consuming 40% of the oil. That's why we're there. It's not because Hussein's a bad guy. It's because we have to have that oil. And so I think we have to understand that. So that's one point. Secondly, I don't think that in execution of our foreign policy, our government acts in a Christian manner. And as Christians, we have to continue to point that out, I think. And thirdly, the idea that we're not willing to have a war go on isn't exactly true either. We've been willing to have a war go on in Nicaragua for the last several years. And we don't care if it's chronic, and we don't care if it's close or a long ways from home. The only thing we care about is who's killed them. And as long as it's not white people, in particular our white people, then a low-intensity conflict, having people fight each other, as we did in Nicaragua, and as we hope, you know, that has been going on, in fact, in the Persian Gulf, is perfectly acceptable to us.
Okay, there's a hand back here.
Yeah, I guess I agree with the person in the center about Kuwait. I just kind of have a problem. There's a lot of European countries, there's Japan, a whole bunch of countries that depend on oil a whole lot more than we do. If over the last 15 years, if we had, you know, minded our own manners here and got our own energy house in order, we wouldn't need that oil. And I guess I agree that, you know, Kuwait was invaded, Hussein's a bad guy and all this, but why are we the first one to jump in there? Mm-hmm. I mean, the day after it happened, there was an admiral from some sort of a defense watchdog institute in Washington. His first thought was, we should exhaust all the diplomatic channels first, and then the UN should go in. And, you know, I think we didn't even, the economic blockade hadn't even started yet, and we had troops.
Yeah. You raised some very good points. First of all, I want to say, certainly, you know, U.S. motives for being in Saudi Arabia are obviously horrendously mixed. And I am totally in agreement with the fact that by far the real reason that we're there is oil. And it's horrendous that we in the entire world have built up a structure that makes us dependent on that kind of a substance in a terribly destabilizing way. Having said that, and I do believe that, nonetheless, this other principle is still a critical one. It's a little bit like in your city saying that, well, the fact that there are two drug gangs going against each other, that's, let them shoot each other. Well, we can't because, you know, innocent people are going to get caught in the way. The world cannot allow this kind of settling of differences in the Middle East. It will not be contained if it's allowed to go on. So even though I do think that in reality, in terms of American foreign policy, that was a rather secondary reason for it, from my perspective, in terms of international law in a post-Cold War era, this is the first opportunity for the United Nations to try and act to enforce international law. To answer a couple of your questions, yes, Japan is by far the most vulnerable country in the world to oil cutoff. On the other hand, Japan is far much too rearmed already for its own good and for the good of Southeast Asia, and its own constitution prohibits the deployment of forces farther than 1,000 miles away from Japan. I'm happy about that. So I think Japan should foot a big part of the bill for an international peacekeeping force, and that's being examined. I will say they've been slow, but the Western European governments have eventually responded. The Western European Union, the WEU countries, are sending forces, naval forces. To get to your real question, though, why does Americans always jump into these things first? Because we are the only country in the world that maintains, at this point, the kind of horrendously expensive, mobile, offensive, rapidly deployable forces that can be there. We've got aircraft carriers floating all over the planet. They cost, it costs $18 billion to buy an aircraft carrier task force. $200 million a year to run one. We've got 14 of them. David here is talking about how the Army has been cautious. Yeah, the Army got really burnt, but the Navy is by far the most interventionary and provocative. Navy and Marines are by far the most interventionary and provocative of the American forces, and the Navy has so far stonewalled on budget cuts. The Navy has said no to arms control. This is the last big remaining issue in the arms control disarmament issue. The Soviets have said, we're getting rid of tanks, we're disbanding our army. You do the same to your Navy and we'll call it a day. And so far we've said no. There's a great unfulfilled agenda here, dismantling America's interventionary type of forces. The reason we're always there so quickly is because we got forces poised all over the planet, most of them at sea.
Why?
Pardon?
Why?
These were forces that were ostensibly designed to fight and win a global war with the Soviet Union.
I guess you have to ask.
And one can deeply question their utility in that role also.
Everything I hear being said here tonight, 1947, 1948, after the Second World War, and this government, he said, well, no, we're going to cut our forces, we're going to get rid of this, we're going to get rid of that. In the meantime, Russia was building. And we thought, well, if we don't build them, then Russia won't build them. And sure, they sat over there and said, no, we aren't building them, and all of a sudden they're one of the mightiest. They are the mightiest. You talked about us being mighty. Even with their cutting back, they still outnumber us greatly in armed forces, in armory, in bombs, in tanks. I think we only lead in aircraft, and that's it.
No, that's not correct. We have the only area in which the Soviet Union is superior to the United States is in ground forces in Europe, and that's what they're withdrawing.
I disagree with you.
Well, you certainly.
Let's
see if you can finish.
Let the gentleman finish.
But still, we played the nice guy. We aren't going to build our armies, and that's what happened. So all of a sudden, we are caught with our pants down around their ankles, and Jimmy Carter was faced with that problem when people started walking on us. They took our people in Iran. We sat there and couldn't do a thing about it. People were doing whatever they wanted to with us. We lost faith, not only in the United States and the world community, just because we were the nice guy. And I can see why we built as we are. Now, maybe we overbuilt. I'd have to agree that we got a lot out there. But then we wander to Saudi Arabia here, and everybody is saying, well, Iraq invaded Kuwait, and the United States was in there.
I think Saudi Arabia asked us to come in to protect them because they did not have the forces. It isn't that we just dropped in on Saudi Arabia and said, hey, we're taking your military air force at their air base at Dar Ar. They didn't do that. Granted, they were there in a hurry, but it isn't that we just jumped in there and took over that air base in Saudi Arabia. And so I can't say that, as it was mentioned, that we invaded that country. We didn't invade. We haven't fired a shot yet.
No one says that we've done any invading there. Okay. I don't know where you got that
impression. That was brought well when you introduced it. These are three places that the United States...
Well, we certainly have intervened.
Intervention
is a fairly neutral term, saying that your forces have been put into place outside of your shores. Whether or not that's appropriate or not is the question.
Okay, misunderstood. And the third one, this gentleman over here said, if we would have had our ducks in a row 15 years ago, we wouldn't have this oil crisis. Well, about that time, I remember we were trying to build nuclear power plants. We had wind power, we had solar power, we had all kinds of things going on. But due to our society and our people, and that's us, we are the ones that determine it. We said, we don't want any nuclear power, it's too dangerous. We don't want wind power, it's too expensive. We can't pay those type of bills or anything else, and it's still being said. So we're still depending on oil. So us as a people, we're going to have to decide what we want, and we're going to have to foot the bill for this. This whole easy living that we have based on oil is our own doing. And we're going to have to accept the fact that there's other ways to do it. But we're going to have to bite the bullet, and we're going to have to spend the bucks. We're going to have to accept ulterior motives of energy, such as nuclear.
Not me.
Either that, or we're going to be fighting these Saudi Arabia wars. We depend on it as a society, one country.